You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, how's it going?
Hello, Lionel. It's going very well. Where are we, Lionel?
We are in London at the headquarters of our sponsors, Rafa. We're in the Galibier meeting room.
Very specific, yeah.
Very specific. Here we are. We are having a little glass of water. There's a very nice Rafa jersey on the wall.
I can see it.
Ah, there we are, Daniel.
French champions jersey.
A new venue for us, this. Very kind of our sponsors, Rafa, to let us have a room for an hour or so.
Yeah, we're next door to Arenberg. But we've got lots of cycling to talk about, so let's crack on. In this episode, we're going to cover some of the talking points. Obviously, we're recording on Thursday, and we've just heard of some pretty dramatic news from the Dubai Tour, where Marcel Kittel appears to have been punched mid-stage by Andrei Grivko. We'll get onto that. In part two, we've got our much-anticipated ethical report on the teams. We're going to run through... Lionel's looking worried about that one already. Mm. We're going to run through all the team sponsors and share with you some of the very rough research that we've done into the companies.
Speak for yourself.
The companies and organizations behind the teams. And I've been
lawyers
busy.
Are
I've
on
been,
standby, aren't
I've
they?
I've been extremely
that?
Busy just to cover myself at this point. And then we're going to also hear in part three from part four, a bit from an evening I was at the other night, a screening of the David Miller film, which now has a title. It's been called The David Miller Project. It now has a title. You'll hear what that is in the final part of today's podcast. And we'll hear a little bit from David Miller, the director, Finlay Pretzel, and our good friend Seb Piquet, who was at the screening and shares his thoughts about the film. But before any of that, Lionel, can you give us the weekly news roundup, please?
Well, I can indeed. It's going to be a whistle-stop tour around the globe because there's been racing in Europe, in the Middle East, in Australia, in South America, been some cyclocross as well. So here goes. We'll start off in Mallorca. The Challenge Mallorca was a cracking race for Lotto Soudal. They won the first three stages. Andre Greipel won one. Tim Wellens won 2 days in a row. Little plug for our Friends of the Podcast special, taking you behind the scenes of Lotto Soudal. It's available now if you want to sign up on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. It's only a tenner. You can pay more if you wish for the year's access. But it's actually two parts. There's also a conversation with Mark Sargent in the second part. The final race of the Challenge Mallorca was won by Britain's Dan McClay. After the finish line, he crashed into a photographer, smashed his face up quite badly. So a bittersweet victory for him. Next stop, get on an aeroplane. We'll head to South America and the Tour de San Juan, where Quickstep, as they now are, have been in dominant form, really. Tom Boonen won a stage. Fernando Gaviria won a couple of stages. Max Richesi won a couple of stages. The overall was taken by the Dutchman Bauke Mollema. Good overall stage race win for him. Second place for Oscar Sevilla, who's 40 years old. So there's hope for us yet, Rich, maybe. Perhaps not. Sniggering there from our Berlin correspondent I picked up. Next off, we'll fly over to Australia. There was the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race. The men's race was won by Nikias Arndt of Sunweb. Women's race was won by Annemiek van Vleuten. The Herald Sun Tour is now underway there. Danny van Poppel of Sky won the prologue time trial. And Orica Scott's Damien Howson has won the second stage. Esteban Chavez and Chris Froome are both in action there. That race concludes at the weekend. Not considering our air miles or carbon footprint here on this global trip around the world, because we'll go back to Europe now, where the Grand Prix Marseillaise was won by Arthur Vichot, Française des Jeux. The Étoile de Bessèges is underway. Arnaud Démare won the opening stage there. Meanwhile, in Spain, the Vuelta a Valenciana, the opening stage with a team time trial won by BMC Racing. Next up, the Middle East and the Dubai Tour. We'll hear a bit more about that later on in the race. Marcel Kittel won the opening two stages. And then, as we're speaking now on Thursday, Kittel had a very different day. He was elbowed or punched, we're not entirely sure just yet exactly what happened, by Astana's Andrei Grivko. Kittel had a cut to the face. Grivko's been disqualified, which is one way to get a day off to go shopping for watches in Dubai, I guess, if that's Grivko's kind of thing. John Degenkolb won that stage. A big morale-boosting win for him. Now he's with Trek Segafredo. Where next? Oh, the Cyclocross Worlds, which are in Luxembourg. There was a...
Daniel's exasperated.
This is...
I mean, yeah, how can there be so much racing?
Just in case. I mean, my head's spinning.
It's only just February.
It's too much. Well, there is too much cycling on at the moment. It's not my fault.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah. So what are we supposed to concentrate on? Let me just wrap up the Cyclocross Worlds, where the young British riders, Tom Pidcock, Daniel Tullett and Ben Turner, took a 1-2-3 in the men's junior race, a fine tribute to their teammate Charlie Craig, who died recently. The pick of the races was probably the women's race. Sanne Kant of Belgium beat Marianne Vos with a dramatic last lap pass. Very icy conditions on the Saturday. It thawed out a bit for the men's race on Sunday. Really muddy, lots of punctures. Wout van Aert won ahead of Matthew van der Poel, who suffered punctures on the second, third, fourth and fifth laps. Van Aert also punctured, but he punctured near the pits, very fortunately. So another Belgian world title. In fact, second year in a row for van Aert. Off the bike, as we revealed last week in the podcast, Damien Collins MP is calling Simon Cope and Dr. Richard Freeman to give evidence. They're being invited to give evidence at the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee hearing into doping in sport. That will be on February the 22nd. And finally, we may talk about this a bit later on, but CBS broadcast their investigation into the phenomenon. Can you see is the scorn coming across here?
Your brow is doing some extraordinary
Things. Well, we'll talk about this a bit later, but the issue of motors in bikes, not sure that story has been moved along terribly much by the CBS 60 Minutes documentary. And breathe. Back in London, let's carry on with the podcast.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff there. It's overwhelming, actually, the amount of racing that's on. I'm not sure we can really talk about it all, and I don't think we will, and I don't think we want to. But you mentioned the incident in Dubai involving Kittel. We can actually hear from Marcel Kittel. Maybe we should just do that now. Let's hear from Marcel Kittel. We've got Hannah Troop out there covering the Dubai Tour for the Cycling Podcast. We'll have a longer report from her last week. She's following in particular the Aqua Blue team, who have made quite an impression actually on the race so far. So we'll hear that next week. But let's hear from Marcel Kittel after the finish of the stage today. He was nursing his wounds after that altercation with Andrei Grivko. Here he is, Marcel Kittel.
Yeah, I guess Grivko had a coffee too much this morning. I don't know what happened with him, but as soon as we went into the crosswinds, there was fighting for positions, of course, and I think it's totally normal that you push sometimes also each other. So I was trying to get in back into the line in the crosswinds. With one of his young teammates, he didn't like that, so he pushed me back, and I tried to go around, came in between Grivko and his teammate, so I also had to push Grivko a little bit, but didn't take my hands off nothing. And in the end, I was trying to talk to the young guy, why he's really taking that risk, and at that moment I get a punch in my face. He made a tough choice, Grivko, I think. I think he should, it's very clear that he should be disqualified, not only for this race, he should get a ban for the next 6 months maybe. It's a terrible disappointment for cycling, it's a shame for this race, it's a shame for his sponsors, for his team, and I really don't understand how he can show this kind of reaction. And of course it's a moment where you have a lot of emotion, it's like a sprint being in a crosswind, but it doesn't give him the right to punch someone else into the face. And 1 centimeter more to the right, he would injure my eye maybe, huh? Because he broke my glasses. And I don't understand at the moment. I hear from the jury that they will not disqualify him because they have no video material, but there are 40 witnesses in the group that saw it. And I absolutely don't understand why there is no decision from the UCI. He sent Bernie Eisel to me that he wanted to apologize, but for what should he apologize? It's too late. There is a very thin line that you can cross. I mean, if you have an argument in the race, you have an argument, you talk about it, okay, maybe even you touch him, you touch the other guy a little bit. No problem, I have no problem with him. But as soon as he injures someone, he takes the risk to injure me, maybe he injures my eye, it's over. There's no feeling sorry, there is no apologize, it's just done. for sure my concentration was not 100% anymore there, but yeah, the day is over now and I try to move on.
We can also hear from Andrei Grifko. Hannah caught up with him back at his hotel in the company of Hugo Kurewitz, the Belgian journalist. Here is Andrei Grifko.
He wanna push me out from this...
From the road?
From the road, yeah. And then I he pushed me one time and I risked to crash.
Yeah.
To also risk the other guy, because if I crash, we crash from 20 riders.
Yeah.
And I tried to put him, I don't have a choice, I tried to put him with my head. But he broke the glasses. I'm sorry for he broke the glasses and he have some problem here. But it was really dangerous because I have a wife at home, a baby, and I don't want to crash in the first race in the season. Broke my legs. Yesterday was first day was crash. The guy broke the collarbone. It's okay. I understand if I say also in the. I speak with another riders, I'm understanding the last 3K when the sprinters have battle for the position. I don't go to battle, I don't do the sprint, but it's not possible to do Abdujaparov on last 100 kilometer. Yeah. You have 100K to go and he did like this. And if he wanna respect, I also respect the riders, but if he have a respect for us, I know for Astana team and particularly, but it's not possible to ride like this. It's dangerous for everybody. I'm really sorry for him, for he have this problem.
Yeah, but you did it. I don't know how you did it.
No, I tried to push him because he continued to with the shoulders. He continued to he 85 kilo. It's 15 kilo difference. He really big guy. And one time it was also windy, 50K per hour. It was really dangerous. And I say, oh, what you do? But he I don't know, he want to take my place and he pushed me again and again. And I tried to, with my hand, I tried to put him back because it's not possible. He not understand me, I don't know. And after he broke the glasses and he was really angry. But he must understand. It's important also about security.
Yeah.
It's every crash, every kilometers. It's you must win with the legs, not with the shoulders. Or in the sprint, I understand it's battle for position. But in the middle of the race, it's not normal.
Did anyone else say anything to you in the race afterwards? Did anyone else make any comments about how he was acting?
Yeah, from another team, the guys asked what happened. Also. Actually, in the race, also him colleague, teammates come. They say, "Yeah, I understand, but you also everybody understand. But he did mistake. I also did mistake. But important to respect each other and do this again. Because I see first day it was a lot of crash. It was really dangerous in last day. It's impossible to ride."
What did Alex say about it?
Huh?
Vinokurov, what did he say?
No, the team just heard the comments about Lefebvre. It was a little bit emotional, I think, comments, because he was in the car, he don't see situation, but he comment like he was in this group. I don't know. We're waiting. I hope maybe speak also with Lefebvre, with Kittel tonight after dinner, and stop this problem and continue the race. You know, not for me, okay, for him. Hoping he can win, but with the legs, I repeat, with the legs, not with the shoulders.
So Marcel Kittel there pulling no punches, so to speak, in his damning assessment of Grifko. Well, I guess, you know, riders are, you know, suspended for doping and other misdemeanors. Then should he be facing a suspension beyond just being disqualified from the race? What do you think, Daniel? Do you think he deserves to be banned?
I'm still reeling from Lionel's news roundup, Rich. I haven't really recovered yet. It's way too much for my tiny brain to cope with. Should he be banned for 6 months? Well, it's impossible. What we need is video replays. We need technology, don't we? If this was football, that's what they'd be saying. I said football analogies were only allowed to whomever's team won the cycling podcast derby, Watford or Arsenal. But it is kind of, it sounds a little bit like cycling's Cantona moment. It was that bad. A punch in the middle of the race. I mean, I understand that Grivko was right at the front of the echelon when it happened, and spoke briefly to Mark Cavendish actually today about what he saw, and he thought that, well, it was extremely dangerous. It could have brought down around 30 riders. Kittel himself had been fairly robust leading up to the punch, I think, in the way he sort of defended his position, but he didn't take his hand off the bars. Grifko did, which of course you're not allowed to do, and yeah, very difficult to know what kind of action should be taken and how commissaires should really police this kind of thing. I mean, really, the best way to police it, if they didn't see it, would be to go around asking riders. But then that's not really fair either, because Grivko, for example, is someone who doesn't have a particularly, well, a unanimously sort of favourable reputation in the peloton. I was speaking to another rider, coincidentally, 10 days or so ago, and he sort of... unprompted, mentioned the fact that Andre Grivko was a very unpopular rider in the peloton.
I mean, we've seen punches thrown before. We've seen riders fighting before. I don't think there's a precedent for anything beyond just disqualification from the race. I could be wrong on that. Can you think of anything, Lionel?
No, I can't think of when... I mean, Mark Renshaw was kicked out of the Tour de France, wasn't he, 1 year for using his head
Julian Dean, wasn't it?
To hold off, really, or to fight, stand his ground, and that
Gianluca
was dangerous.
Gianluca Brambilla at the Vuelta 1 year with Ivan Rovni.
Yeah, I remember a famous incident that Sean Kelly told me about with Eric van der Aarden after a race in France. They'd been pulling jerseys and pushing each other in the sprint finish, and afterwards squared up against each other, and van der Aarden aimed a kick at Sean Kelly's most sensitive area, shall we put it that way, and as he swung his foot to connect with Sean's nether regions, his standing foot slipped from under him and he fell over backwards, and then they were basically sort of brawling. So there have been incidents in the past where, you know, riders have got far too physical, and when there are echelons, you know, the fight for space on the road can be the difference between staying in a group and not staying in a group, but there really is no excuse for taking your hands off the bars. You know, does it send a strong enough message just to disqualify him? I'm not entirely sure, but you know, if there isn't a precedent, then it's difficult to know. Certainly, without any evidence, it's difficult to know what the just punishment would be.
And otherwise, in the Dubai Tour, Kittel has been looking extremely impressive. I mean, Daniel, you spoke to Mark Cavendish. He was second today to Degenkolb. A few people sceptical about his claims that he suffered a puncture in stage one. Certainly Adam Blythe, who was on his wheel, said that he saw no evidence of a puncture, as Cavendish later claimed. But how's his mood? Is he happy? Is he a little bit frustrated?
That was slightly uncharitable of Blythe as a former teammate, wasn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah. He's pretty satisfied, Cavendish, with how he's going. Thinks he's in good form. Hasn't quite worked out for him in the sprints. But generally, a bit like I was kind of reeling from Lionel's news roundup, I think Cavendish and other riders this week have just been felt slightly beleaguered by the speed of the racing, how chaotic the racing has been, and you know, particularly in an environment or in a race like Dubai, where we saw today sandstorms and, you know, echelons, and I think we hear it every year now, riders get back into the mix at the start of the season and they can't quite believe how fast the racing is, and you know, that sort of the old kind of ride by consensus, that old sort of those old unspoken rules and agreements whereby a peloton would kind of it would ease itself into the season or ease itself into races or ease itself into the first couple of hours of races, doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, for various reasons that we've discussed numerous times on the podcast, and cycling is much more global now, and there isn't the same community. Also, in a linguistic sense, so cosmopolitan now, the peloton, so many different interests being represented, stakes are high, and there isn't really a committee mentality or a communal mentality, whereby, you know, a decision is taken for everyone. So it's kind of eyeballs out right from the start all the time. And Cavendish certainly said this week that he's feeling quite old, you know, certainly with all the young guns coming in and blazing a trail.
Cavendish makes a very amusing couple of cameos in the David Miller film that I mentioned earlier. I'll mention that again in the final part. A couple of other little stories caught my eye before we go on to our team's ethical report. Daniel, I mean, what did you make of the CBS investigation? Much trailed. Did it promise more than it delivered in terms of, you know, hard facts to, as Lionel said, take the story on?
Well, I think so. I mean, as always with these things, they were limited by time, and, you know, it was about a 15-minute program, and I suppose there's a limited amount that you can put into something like that. Istvan Varga still doesn't quite convince me. He sort of has a glint in his eye, a mischievous look about
him.
He's
a Hungarian who's the inventor of the motor.
Yeah, and there are certain things about his story that don't fully add up to me, and there's it seems to me an awful lot like this whole story is based on one source at the moment, or people related to that one source as well. But you know, I think we have to keep an open mind. It does look as though at some point motors have been used, but I don't think there's anything at this point which allows us to identify exactly when or by whom that was. I mean, just on the sort of broader issue and the kind of this idea that seems to be gathering pace that there's been some kind of cover-up over the last few years. I mean, I talked about the sort of erosion of this kind of hive mind, this kind of communal spirit in cycling, or some would call it a law of silence. This kind of atmosphere or this mood that has prevailed in cycling for decades, whereby, you know, things are kept in the family and everyone looks after each other's interests. I mean, I do think it still prevails in some respects. And just thinking about motors and the comparison with doping and doping epidemics in the past, and particularly the EPO epidemic, I mean, I kind of think that was able to survive and flourish for so long because it was kind of in everyone's interest for a long time. You know, it made the racing easier for riders. They were scared of speaking out. They had authoritarian figures keeping that kind of law of silence in place, whether it was Hein Verbruggen or maybe Lance Armstrong at the top of the tree. And it kind of suited everyone. It was too difficult to break rank. I don't really think it's in the broader peloton or the sport's interest to have people winning big races on using a motor. And therefore, I do not think you would be able to keep a lid on it for very long.
Well, it's not in bike manufacturers' interests, is it? And they are big stakeholders in the professional sport. So you would imagine that if it goes on, it goes on without the knowledge of the bike manufacturers. That's what I would assume.
Yeah, and surely not in the governing body's interests either. I mean, if you think about the possible implications of this being uncovered.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our sponsor, Science in Sport. Very grateful to them for their support this year. They are offering, every week they're offering a discount to our listeners of 20% off if you enter the code TCP20 at scienceandsport.com. You'll get 20% off. They're also offering a prize to one or two lucky listeners, tickets to the London Bike Show, two tickets to the London Bike Show on the 16th of February. They will have Chris Hoy there that day. He's a Science and Sport ambassador. He will be there appearing on the stage that day, so you can see him and enjoy the London Bike Show. And also, in addition to the tickets, win £100 worth of Science and Sport product. Please, to enter this competition, go to scienceandsport.com/thecyclingpodcast. That's scienceandsport.com/thecyclingpodcast. Enter the competition there and good luck. That's on the 16th of February. Now, fellas, in this part of the today's show, we were going to turn our attention to the teams and the sponsors. There are a couple of reasons for this. Before we run through each team, maybe we should hear from somebody who knows a bit about sponsorship, and that is Chris Alfred, who's a bit of a sports sponsorship expert and works for IG Markets, who were a co-sponsor at Team Sky. a few years ago. One of the reasons for this is that we did an episode of Friends Special last year, 2020 Vision, and one comment that was made actually by Stephen Moon of Science and Sport was that we didn't have the point of view in there of a sponsor and what sponsors are looking for from their involvement with cycling. So to introduce our run through the teams and their sponsors, let's hear from Chris Alford. Here he is now.
Is it the fact that the teams are known by the sponsor name, is that appealing to sponsors as well, or is that a problem in terms of the sort of long-term stability of the teams?
I think it's both. I think you don't get many naming title sponsorship rights in the sports world now, or in anything. There are still examples of them, but the problem is it sets an unrealistic expectation. It's an overvaluation of what it is. What you have is a team selling everything and not keeping anything. There is no professional cycling team which has a brand in its own right, really, apart from the ones who've tried to create them, you know, like Green Edge, and, you know, Slipstream Sports to a certain degree. And that's a problem, because if you look in other sports, you know, Manchester United has created this brand over many, many years, and the reason why they're so commercially successful now is they're selling, you know, they're a franchise company. They have built an audience around the world, which they then sell rights to many different companies around the world for many different products. You know, they even have a potato crisps official sponsor. But for those businesses who sponsor that team, they make money off the back of their sponsorships. They can prove it. They can justify it to their businesses. In cycling, the pitch to sponsor a professional cycling team is you get this, your name in shining lights and great big brand exposure. But after 3 years of that, has it actually paid off the £30 million you paid over 3 years to title sponsorship? Often not. But you hit the nail on the head. The problem is if you took that away from cycling, if you said you couldn't have title sponsorship, then brands wouldn't pay as much. And the teams wouldn't be able to function. It's 80% of their income, I think, on average. So it wouldn't work.
We see sponsors getting involved with teams, maybe taking over naming rights or coming in as a secondary sponsor. Alpecin have hooked up with Katusha. We've got Drapac at Cannondale. IG were in a similar situation in 2011, not as a naming sponsor, but as a secondary sponsor at Team Sky. How difficult is it for a sponsor coming into an established team to carve out their own bit of exposure and get some kind of payback from what's probably quite a big investment?
Yeah, it's hard. You have it in a lot of sponsorships now. You know, there's never one sponsor really in any sort of organization. And the thing of having titles is it does take the ownership and does take dominance. That's even doubly hard. What you've got to do, and we do it now with Harlequins Rugby Club, is you know, DHL are the main sponsor there, big yellow logo on the front and we're on the side, is you've got to create in the partnership something which is truly yours. So you were talking earlier about Backstage Pass, which Orica Green Edge did. If I was in there, if I was Bike Exchange, I'd be all over that piece of content. Or you've got to take ownership of one part of the team. So it happened in Manchester United recently, that Aeon were a front of shirt and DHL came in and then took over all the training kit. So they had all the training kit sponsorship, but then they named the training base after them and they produced a whole campaign about being the delivery partner, you know, helping the team deliver on the pitch, all that messaging which they wanted to do, which links back to the product. So you've got to look at it as a team and try and carve out how can you get your message across in the amount of rights, branding, or the story you're trying to say.
I mean, position on the kit, you know, on the jersey or the shorts, how much IG got a quite prime real estate being on the back of the shorts, but how much thought goes into that?
Quite a lot. Sky were ahead of the game on this, and I've been through reports. You know, we tracked it at every race for 2 or 3 years, and you analyse where the position is. And Sky each year would move the position on the shoulders. They would do research and move the Sky logo a different angle where they'd see it. You can get really, really scientific on it, and you know, you could argue that the bum of the jersey on Team Sky is not actually as valuable as someone like Vacon Soleil or something during that year when you've got Thomas De Gendt going up the road the whole time. You know, that's a prime arse to be on, so to speak.
Okay, so that was Chris Alfred with a few interesting things to say about the model, I suppose, in sponsoring professional cycling and what sponsors are looking to get out of the sport. And to expand on that, we were going to run through each team and, you know, look at who sponsors the team, who they are. And we're joking about the ethical report. We should point out we're talking here not about the team ethics so much. We're not talking about doping. We're looking at corporate ethics, I suppose, and whether I suppose cycling and cycling sponsorship mirrors the rest of society, and that's probably reflected in the sponsors of the sport, which puts fans sometimes in a potentially difficult position, perhaps, if they've got misgivings, concerns about some of the backers of the sport that they love. And we'll get on to talking about that more generally once we've rattled through the teams.
And there have been, Rich, just to point out, some... well, particularly this year, we've had a bit of correspondence, haven't we, about fans' misgivings about one team in particular, and that's the Bahrain team.
Yeah, Bahrain, new sponsor, you know, Kingdom of Bahrain sponsoring a team. Vincenzo Nibali leads that team. And we've had a few emails and tweets and so on from listeners asking, because there is some controversy around the Bahrain regime. So let's kick off with Bahrain. Lionel, over to you.
Yes, sharp intake of breath, because...
You've got 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
30 well, seconds, Napalm, and that sharp intake of breath took about four.
Well,
so
if I talk...
And your intervention's taking about 12.
Yeah, and if I talk slowly, there's less chance of alerting the libel lawyers, isn't there? So let's drag this out. No, joking apart, I mean, the issue is that the Bahrain Merida team is sponsored, financed by the Bahrain government to promote the country. I think everybody will know that it's an oil-rich state, it's a monarchy, and a lot of the states in the Gulf, you know, they're sitting on all this oil, but they need to diversify their economies into other areas. You know, looking at the long-term view, when the oil runs out, and the different states have taken a different approach. The controversy with Bahrain is that it is not a country that has a gleaming human rights record. And the Amnesty International report, the most recent one, reads, the government continued to curtail freedoms of expression, association and assembly, and crack down further on online and other dissent. Opposition leaders remained imprisoned. Some were prisoners of conscience. Torture and other ill-treatment remained common. Although in the last year there hadn't been any executions, last month Bahrain carried out 3 executions, the country's first for 6 years. The 3 executed men have been accused of killing police officers. I should point out, you know, Bahrain is not the only country in the world that has the death penalty. Parts of the US do, China does. But this is a case where the state itself is sponsoring the team directly. And we are led to believe that Prince Sheikh Nasser bin Hamad Al Khalifa is going to be a sort of figurehead for the team as the season rolls on. And we may well see him at races. So the controversy is that about whether or not Bahrain is an ethical sponsor to be involved in professional cycling.
Nice pronunciation of Bahrain there, Lionel.
Well, I'm very wary of the pronunciation police.
We don't want Rob Hatch on our backs, do we? Daniel, do you want to introduce another team?
Yes. Okay, Rich, I'll go early in the alphabet as well. So I was given AG2R Prévoyance, big French company, gross income of nearly 30 billion euros in 2015, net profit 300 million euros. There have been various accusations of anti-competitive practices against AG2R Group. They're an insurer mainly, or pensions company. They're involved in one very contentious case in France where they stand accused of anti-competitive practice in insuring members of the French National Federation of Bakers. Basically, in 2007, the National Federation of French Bakers signed a deal for health insurance for all of their members, obliging every French baker to have AG2R health insurance. Other insurers looked at the policies, thought that it was a bad deal, offered some of the bakers alternatives. AG2R found out, got very angry, started legal action. They won the case, but they didn't come out of it particularly well. And there was also no auction. It was found that there had been no auction in this deal, which there should have been. So that was deemed slightly anti-competitive. It was also found that the head of the Bakers Federation had links to the AG2R group when the deal was signed. So that's a bit of unsavoury business, something to think about when you're munching on your next baguette or wondering why Roman Bardet doesn't get his sleeves cut.
Well, keeping it fairly alphabetical, why move on to Astana? And, similar allegations can be made about Astana or Kazakhstan as about the Bahrain team. I mean, Astana were the forerunners, I guess, as a team that's sponsored by a country. They bear the name of the capital city of Kazakhstan. And again, I'll read a bit of the Amnesty report into Kazakhstan for 2015-2016. Impunity for torture and other ill treatment remained largely unchallenged, they say, and there was still no independent full investigation into reports of torture following the suppression of the Zanausen protests in 2011. Freedoms of expression, association and peaceful assembly continue to be restricted. Big concerns as well in Kazakhstan about how democratic it is. President Nazarbayev has been the only leader of that country since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the opening up of the old Soviet Union. He was re-elected to a fifth term in office recently, winning 97.7% of the vote, which is a very impressive margin. Well done to him. Astana have been around a long time now, since 2006. The money comes from the Samruk Kazina Fund, which is worth still $78 billion. Or it has assets of $78 billion. There was a lot of focus around Expo 2017. The team have had that on their kit and bus and so on for a few years. So it seemed to be that 2017 was going to be a real focal point. I gather that winning the Giro was a big target. Winning a Grand Tour was a huge target for Astana. They won the Tour with Nibali in 2014, but the Giro last year was a big thing as well. And the rumour is that the team maybe has another 2 years. So 2019 might be the last we see of Astana. We've spoken in the past about how sort of threadbare their squad looks really this year, especially if they now lose Andrei Grivko for a few months, they'll be even more threadbare, who knows. But they're led by Fabio Aru, and as the Amnesty report says, there are concerns about, you know, democracy and human rights in Kazakhstan, just as there are in Bahrain. Move on.
I mean, we're going to need to tighten these up a bit, aren't we? I mean,
we've got to be quicker. We've got to be quicker, chaps.
Lotto Soudal. What can be more wholesome than a national lottery, persuading the public to pay a pound, or in the case of Belgium, a euro or two, in the hope of winning tens or possibly hundreds of millions of euros? There's always been a bit of controversy over the way the lottery spends its money, although it funds initiatives for young people and charities and sort of props up the cultural and sporting aspects of life in Belgium. There's nevertheless always, never far away from lotteries, the suspicion that they're a kind of a tax on people, really, by the back door. That's what some people say. I'm necessarily saying that myself.
Well, Weasley, that's what some people say.
What some people say.
Some people say.
In 2016, the Belgian Lotto turned over 1.183 billion euros, and they paid out 865 million euros in prizes. So that's quite a high proportion of the turnover being paid out in prizes. However, a few years ago, there was a bit of a scandal in Belgium, because when winners of huge sums of money didn't want their identities to be made public, the lottery were accused of changing the identities of the people who'd won. So for one example, was that an elderly woman in a remote village won, but the lottery said that a wholesome family living in Ghent won. And the allegation was that they were changing the identities of the winners in order to make the game more appealing to a larger demographic. They kind of got away with that one, I think. Soudal make adhesives and sealants, which are absolutely fine,
particularly
since they've removed all the things that teenagers like to sniff in order to get high.
Okay, well, let's keep with the lottery theme.
Lottery?
Yeah,
I've got a lottery as well. Have you got a lottery?
I've got a lottery.
Well, I'll do my lottery first. Okay. I've got the FDJ, Française des Jeux. They've just announced their highest ever sales, 14 billion euros in 2016. That's between lottery tickets and scratch cards. 25 million regular players in France. It's a state-run company, which you think might give it a pristine reputation, but not quite the case. There's the obvious issue of exploiting vulnerable people's weaknesses, as Napalm just alluded to. And in fact, there are 600,000 addicts, scratch card addicts in France, apparently, at the moment. FDJ does, though, support or fund a charity helping addicts with SOS Joueur, SOS Players organization. And there's also a story that caught my eye about a lawsuit brought in 2013 by a 67-year-old regular scratch card player who claimed that FDJ and its retailers were misleading customers with their quotas of winning cards. Basically, the gist was that every batch had a quota of winning cards, and once these had been sold, all advertised claims of payout probability were fundamentally wrong and deceitful. Now, he did lose his case, though, this gentleman, and he had to pay 10,000 euros for defamation of FDJ, but he was supported publicly by a former director of the company. One final semi-related note, Jeremy Roy, who has been a long-serving Française des Jeux rider, has been on the French Cycling Federation's Commission for Sustainable Development since 2009. He's probably the peloton's most vocal spokesman about environmental issues, so well done, Jeremy.
Yeah, points for that. Well, Lotto NL Jumbo, Lotto NL, been in sport a couple of years now, and same reservations, I suppose, about lottery in Netherlands as anywhere else. But they do give 60% of their ticket revenue back to their customers in the form of prize money. Do you know the Dutch lottery is the world's oldest continuous lottery. It started in 1726 in The Hague. And little did they know they'd one day be sponsoring Bram Tankic and friends. but Lotto NL is one of the sponsors. Jumbo is the chain of supermarkets in the Netherlands, second largest retail chain in the country. The other name associated with the team is Brand Loyalty, and there's a speed skating team as part of that setup as well. Don't have any dirt on the Dutch lottery. I'm sure there is some, but my very cursory research hasn't revealed it yet.
I'm sure Jumbo, like every supermarket, put the vegetables that are closest to going out of date at the front,
They lose a few points for that. My research was going to involve a phone call to Dan Hackenberg, but unfortunately I never got around to it, so I'll return to the Dutch lottery at some point.
Well, shall I move on to Cannondale Drapac, and I'll read the Amnesty International report into Cannondale. Cannondale is your original mom and pop company formed by Joe Montgomery in 1971 to make a bicycle-towed trailer called the Bugger. The company takes its name from the Cannondale train station in Wilton, Connecticut. And, you know, for many years they just made backpacks and bags and that would fit onto panniers and handlebars. And then they eventually expanded into clothing. And finally, in 1983, they started making bicycles. And the oversized aluminium tubes were their sort of signature design, weren't they? And in the 90s, they sponsored Mario Cipollini, who really made them preeminent bike manufacturing company as the American companies moved in. Cannondale was bought by Doral Industries, a Canadian company, in 2008 for $200 million. Shortly after that, all manufacturing was moved to Taiwan, so presumably not high up on Donald Trump's list of favoured companies, being both based in Canada and manufacturing everything in the Far East. Should maybe mention Drapac Capital Partners. Well, Drapac or Drapac, not sure, tomato, tomato. We still haven't got the definitive pronunciation of that. Maybe somebody can help us out. It's an Australian property funds management business founded by Michael Drapac in 2011. On its website, it says, it says that its USP is that they co-invest, so they always have skin in the game, which sounds good because if they win or lose, the client wins or loses. The bit that makes me feel a little uncomfortable is that they boast that they identify value through unorthodox means. That means capitalising on the unprecedented opportunities following the financial crisis. But maybe they're the ideal partner for Cannondale, who identify value through unorthodox means by not winning any World Tour bike races.
Ooh. Nasty.
Daniel, can you give us another one?
Okay, I'm going to take Bora Hansgrohe. I think Bora Hansgrohe might be the yellow jerseys as far as ethics are concerned in the peloton. Didn't find anything. Bora found it in 2007. In 2010, they only had 6 employees. They've got more employees called Sagan than that now, haven't they? They make kitchen appliances, extractor systems, and just a very impressive company by the sounds of it. Hansgrohe make bathroom fittings. Interesting story here, which reminded me a lot of the story about Adidas and Puma, they were founded by two brothers from the same family, and there was a feud at some point in time, and they split into two separate companies, and there's a very good book about that called Sneaker Wars. But very similar with Grohe and Hansgrohe, both German bathroom fittings companies, and in the 1930s there was a dispute between two half-brothers and they split, and now are fierce rivals. And there was a story in 2011 about a Chinese company in which Grohe has stakes and plagiarizing Hansgrohe taps, which has got you riveted, I can tell, Richard. and that's about all I found.
That's fantastic. Well, I'll do a quick one. Team Sunweb, new sponsor this year. Sunweb, holiday company, holiday brand within the Sundeo Group. Not a huge company, Sundeo. 400 employees, €380 million turnover in 2015. I was more interested by one of the other brands as part of this under the Sundeo umbrella. Sunweb are one aspect of the business, a certain type of holiday. Sunweb, probably guess roughly. I imagine holidays involve sun. Clues in the name. But another of their brands, and the original one, in fact, was GoGo Tours. And GoGo Tours is the number one sort of holidays for youngsters. I thought Daniel might be particularly interested in this. Party holidays is what they do. Party holidays for 16 to 26-year-olds. And ooh, they go...
Don't make
they
it.
They use the hashtag party hard.
Wow.
That's Sunweb. Wouldn't we rather have seen them as Team GoGo?
We would have done, yeah. We would have done.
Have we done 9 now? Have we reached half time?
We have
probably
reached half
time. Let's take a break.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. I'm very grateful indeed to them. Of course, if they sponsored a World Tour team, I've no doubt at all they'd be top of the ethical table, wouldn't they?
And fabulous.
They'd sport a beautifully tailored yellow jersey in recognition of that fact. Anyway, let's really rattle through the remaining 9 teams. But before we do, let's briefly ponder the question: does it matter? You know, does it matter, particularly, I suppose, to fans of the sport? Do the ethics of the sponsors, the other entities backing the teams, matter, Daniel?
Well, I think it certainly does to the fans, or it certainly should do and can do, and that is the saving grace of all of this, that fans can make their choices based on, you know, which sponsors and which team has the image that's most congenial to them. But I think as far as riders are concerned, and whether we should expect riders to make choices on which team they ride for based on the sponsor's ethics, I think that's maybe a bit unrealistic. I mean, you take the case of someone like Nibali last year, and he's gone to the Bahrain team. Well, effectively, he had a choice of two teams at most, I would say, Trek and Bahrain. Trek weren't willing to take on his whole entourage, and the talks broke down. So effectively, he was only left with one team to choose from. And, you know, we talked recently about the lack of security in cycling, short contracts, and just also the culture. I mean, it's interesting that there are sports where athletes do tend to take an ethical stand. The NBA is one good example, and we saw that during the Trump campaign, as compared to, for example, the NFL, where the players were conspicuous through their silence on the election and that kind of issue. But in cycling, where there's so little security, I think it's perhaps a bit naive, unrealistic to expect riders to be too outspoken and principled about these things.
Cycling isn't like the NBA or the NFL or many other sports. The teams are put on the road directly by the sponsors. Jonathan Vaught has made that point very eloquently in the 2020 Vision episode and also to us on the podcast at the end of last year. The teams are so dependent on sponsorship money that perhaps the ethical concerns do come a little bit further down the list than they might otherwise.
I mean, as far as the fans are concerned, I suppose the only thing to say is that sport, professional sport and cycling, they don't exist in a vacuum, do they? They mirror what's happening in the rest of the world. And I think sometimes fans, we all project sort of unrealistic ideals onto sport, imagining that it's somehow separate to the rest of the murky, muddy waters of the world, and it's not. It's just part of and indeed mirrors that world. So and it's why we're so shocked when there are doping cases, because, like I say, we have unrealistic expectations of what sport is. But the reality is that professional sport is professional sport. Shall we carry on rattling through the teams, Lionel? Can you kick us back off?
I can indeed, yes. Well, next up, it's BMC, the bicycle manufacturing company, a Swiss-based company owned by Andy Rees, who's a very, very rich man, a Santa Claus lookalike and a very big cycling fan. Compared to some of the other bike manufacturers that sponsor World Tour teams, BMC are pretty small. Basically, their turnover is about a quarter of somebody like Trek or Specialized or Cannondale. Although it's difficult to find out too much detail about their finances because they're a private Swiss company and they don't have to reveal too much. But we gather from accounts published in 2015 that around about half of their sales are accounted for by BMC bikes. And so that really indicates that this is very much a project, the BMC racing team is very much a project that Andy Rees is keeping afloat with his own money. The rest of the money comes from other bike brands, including the Stroma electronic bikes, which can reach speeds of 45 kilometres an hour. Now, e-bikes are very environmentally friendly, very ethical, as long as you don't ride one in the Tour de France, of course.
No, indeed. Well, I'll carry on with another bike company, shall I? Trek Segafredo. Trek, you know, did have for many years, do have a wholesome image, a family firm set up by Dick Burke. John Burke is the current man at the helm. 1,800 employees at Trek. I mentioned the wholesome image. Employees get a free breakfast if they cycle a certain distance to work.
What do they get, Rich? Mm. Pop-Tarts?
Well, or American breakfasts are pretty impressive. So if it's a big American breakfast, then it'd certainly be worth it. I think even Lionel would probably commit to cycling that 12 or 13 miles to work every day. They're also connected to People for Bikes, the team, which is a non-profit, lobbies for more and better biking infrastructure in the US. But there is a blot against the Trek name for two reasons, though I suppose those two reasons are linked. They supplied bikes to Lance Armstrong, of course, and they were also involved in an ugly dispute with Greg LeMond, the three-time Tour winner, who the Trek were for many years licensed to sell LeMond bikes, but they fell out after LeMond was critical of Armstrong and Dr. Michele Ferrari. Burke at the time said that LeMond has done and said things that have damaged the LeMond brand and the Trek brand as a whole. The dispute was ostensibly about bikes, but it also seemed to be about Armstrong. And the Trek, I suppose you could say, were on the wrong side of history with that one. So it was pretty ugly, and we'll leave a not very pleasant memory for some cycling fans, but they sponsor World Tour team now. I have to say that the case with LeMond and Trek was settled out of court in 2010. The co-sponsor Segafredo, Italian coffee, it's part of the huge Massimo Zanetti coffee company turnover of $1.2 billion a year. Interesting little factoid about Segafredo, they have outlets in as many countries as Starbucks. There you go. Daniel?
Sorry, is there anything in the Segafredo ethical handbook about what time certain coffees can be drunk?
No.
They're very laissez-faire. They're happy for people to drink cappuccinos at any time, not surprisingly.
Oh, Lionel, I've just read an article in the Mirror about why Arsenal lost to Watford, and it's because of the cappuccino culture that prevails in Arsenal, apparently. Anyway, Movistar are part of the Telefonica Group, a huge company. And this is one thing I didn't mention, actually, when we were talking about ethics, just the number of these sponsors now, which are absolutely enormous companies or individuals with huge fortunes. And I suppose that increases the likelihood of, things like fiscal jiggery pokery and so forth. Anyway, Movistar, part of the Telefonica Group. Telefonica Group has an annual revenue of over 50 billion euros. Based in Madrid, so it's one of the biggest telephone mobile network operators in the world. Doesn't have a terribly sparkling record as far as customer service is concerned, at least according to the consumer organization Facua, which has named Movistar the worst company of the year. Four times in the last 7 years. In fact, there have only been 7 editions of their prize, and Movistar have won it 4 times. So congratulations, Movistar. You've done better in that than you have in the Tour de France. They've also been sanctioned various times for anti-competitive practices in both the phone and the internet fields. And last year it was reported that Rodrigo Rato, who's the ex-finance minister of Spain and an assessor to Movistar, had been arrested for fraud, embezzlement, money laundering. And I think that case is ongoing. So, a copy book that's not entirely free of blots.
Are they a bad employer for making an old man like Alejandro Valverde ride all 3 Grand Tours in the same year? That seems like the sort of
they only did that last year, didn't they? But yeah, fair enough.
Well, he's getting on. He's getting on a bit, isn't he? I mean, he should be in an ergonomic chair, in a
point. Points off Movistar for making Alejandro Valverde ride all 3 Grand Tours.
That's the next form of motor or electronic doping or mechanical doping, isn't it? Stair lifts up Mont Ventoux.
Carry on, Lionel.
I'm wondering about how these teams were allocated. I've got Sky, which is a company that does divide people. Talking of big companies, Sky is a giant. It's actually a subsidiary of 21st Century Fox, whose logo also appears on the Team Sky jersey. It's the fourth largest media company in the world, and arguably even more powerful than some of those ahead of it. 21st Century Fox was created in 2013 when Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation split in two. It owns film companies, TV stations like Fox News in the US, Sky in the UK, Germany and Italy, TV production companies and other sports channels. Sky, of course, pays billions of pounds to the Premier League, so it's got to lose points for that. And although Team Sky has one of the larger budgets in the World Tour, the cycling team only accounts for a couple of percent of Sky's annual marketing budget. The reason that a lot of people don't like the company is because it's controlled by the Murdochs, they're not universally popular, although Sky itself is not as linked to the newspaper operation anymore since the phone hacking scandal that engulfed the British tabloids a few years ago, and that led to the closure of the News of the World and really cast a shadow over the whole of the business. For those who don't know, investigators working for the paper were found to have hacked into the phones of all sorts of people, mostly celebrities, to listen to their voicemail to gain information for their stories. But the most appalling hack was when they hacked into the mobile phone of a schoolgirl called Millie Dowler, who'd gone missing, and it turned out that she'd been murdered. But the act of listening and deleting the messages gave the family and the police hope that she was still alive, and it really doesn't get much worse than that. And there were some big penalties for the business to pay. There's still obviously a suspicion that Murdoch is too powerful and that his press and broadcast operations are too partisan. It's the image of the team, of the sort of the jokes about the Death Star and the black uniforms, and the sort of the stormtrooper approach to riding, perhaps mirrors the image that the company has itself. Although it should also be pointed out that they've got quite a few environmental initiatives, planting trees, encouraging their employees to ride bicycles. So they win a few points back for that.
Thank you, Napalm. I'll move on to Quickstep Floors, back as the main sponsor of the Belgian team this year. Been involved in cycling for many years, laminated flooring, of course, and who of us doesn't have Quickstep flooring? This harks back to the discussion about whether the ethics matter. I think cycling fans do have often an emotional connection to brands that associate themselves with cycling, so it does matter, I guess. But Quickstep Flooring, actually, there it's a brand that's part of a big American company called Mohawk Industries, which is a giant supplier of commercial and residential flooring. A family set-up company, William Shuttleworth and his sons, in 1875, arrived in the US and set up a carpet mill in the Hudson Valley originally. I was trying to find any kind of dirt on Quickstep or Mohawk Industries, and there was a case in 2009 that went to the Supreme Court. Norman Carpenter, an employee of Mohawk, emailed their human resources department claiming that the company was employing undocumented immigrants. Carpenter was directed to meet with a lawyer representing the company, who allegedly pressured Carpenter to recant his statements. This proceeded through the courts, this case, and it went from 2006 all the way up to 2009. I was trying to work out what actually happened in the end, and this is the sort of legal summary that I heard, or that I read, rather. And if anybody can translate it for me, I'd be very grateful, because I am none the wiser about who actually won this case. If anybody can help me, if some of the great legal minds that listen to the podcast can help out. Here we go. The Federal District Court ordered Mohawk to disclose the information, but permitted the company to appeal. On appeal, the US Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit held that it lacked jurisdiction to review the order for discovery. It reasoned that while the Supreme Court's decision in Cohen versus Beneficial Industrial Loan Corp provided an exception to the finality requirement necessary for an appellant court to have jurisdiction over appeals, the appeal of a discovery order involving attorney-client privilege did not qualify for exemption. So for exception. So that clears that one up. Next team, anyone? Can either of you know what that means? Or,
well, that does read a lot like, or it sound a lot like, the press release that you usually get from Italian professional division teams after they've, I don't know, missed out on a World Cup.
Stuck them through Google Translate.
Not mentioning any names, yeah. Katusha Alpecin next up for me, Rich. Team started by Igor Makarov. Igor Makarov is a former cyclist, has become a very rich man. When the public sector resources were kind of shared out after the Soviet Union broke up at the start of the 1990s, Igor Makarov came by some oil and access to oil in Turkmenistan. And
he came by some oil.
Yeah. He had friends in high places. There were some people in the Turkmen government who admired his work in the Velo Bowl, apparently. He was an indoor cyclist. So anyway, that's how he came by millions of hectares of oil fields in Turkmenistan, apparently. And he set up Russia's first independent gas company, the main extractor of Turkmen oil, became very, very rich over the years. There have been various claims about, well, his company was called Itera, and their dangerous liaisons with Gazprom. Gazprom was a state-owned Russian gas company. Makarov survived FBI investigation, allegations of asset stripping. He owns two private jets, one worth $20 million, one worth $80 million, apparently. So, as I say, I'm a very wealthy gentleman. And really, sort of a lot of the stories about Makarov are kind of the sort of stereotypical stories you hear about Russian businessmen, Russian oligarchs, whispers of mafia involvement never proven. And on the cycling front, the CERC report that was released by the UCI 2 years ago was very critical of Makarov's influence in the run-up to the 2013 UCI presidential elections. Makarov was very outspoken or explicit in his support of Brian Cookson, to the extent that he hired a private investigator to compile a dossier on Pat McQuaid, Cookson's predecessor. Makarov is still a member of the UCI Management Committee. He
Still sponsors European, African, Pan American cycling confederations, so that, and they account for 30 voting delegates in the UCI presidential election. So that might be a factor again when the UCI presidential elections happen in the autumn. As far as Alpecin are concerned, not too much on them. There have been claims that their miraculous caffeine shampoo doesn't actually grow hair back. We haven't done our own experiment on that with Lionel yet.
It doesn't work. I've been trying it for months.
It works on you though, Daniel.
It does. And there were some curious stories in the German press, the Berlin press, around Christmas about Chinese tourists coming over and pillaging German supermarkets for their Alpecin shampoo.
Sure, they weren't just purchasing it.
Before
we get in more trouble.
In large quantities and selling it on the black market in China, because it's very sought after in China, apparently. Anyway.
Wow, we must be up to final teams now.
Yeah, I think we are.
You've got one more to go.
Nearing the bitter end.
Well, this is Orica Scott.
Will we save them for last? We save them for last. Because I'll go very quickly through Dimension Data. Huge company, $7.5 billion turnover, 30,000 employees, actually part of the even bigger Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Group in Japan, who they have a turnover of 11.095 trillion yen, whatever that is, but it sounds like an awful lot of money. Government of Japan, the government of Japan actually owns a 32% stake in Nippon, but they have 240,000 employees worldwide. But Dimension Data has its roots in South Africa. There's a bit of controversy over who actually started the company. Werner Sievers started it apparently in 1982, although it's reported usually that three school friends began the company in 1983. They're a huge company. Couldn't find anything to worry about ethically, so clean bill of health for them. Of course, they've got an agreement with the Tour de France as well, sponsoring a team. Their data, they manage the data at the Tour de France. What would you call it? They manage the data solutions, all these terms that they do, network integration, security solutions, data center solutions, lots of things that we don't really understand, but they've clearly been in this business long before the internet really became a thing. So they've done very well. Jolly good to them, Dimension Data. Next team, Daniel?
UAE Abu Dhabi, the team that's taken over from Lamprey. Now, the UAE has put its name to this team. It's not really clear to what extent the money is coming from the government. I'm actually waiting for a call from Mauro Giannetti, the former Saunier Duval team manager, who has brokered the deal between the former Lamprey team and UAE. And he was supposed to explain to me exactly where the money is coming from. Unfortunately, he hasn't called me back. But the one of the team owners is a gentleman called Matar Sohail Al Yabhuni Al Dahiri. He is the president of the Abu Dhabi Horse Racing Committee, member of the board of the Abu Dhabi Sports Council. UAE is subject really to similar allegations as have been leveled at Bahrain on the human rights front. So about repression, undemocratic nature of government, and lack of free speech.
Great. Lionel, over to you.
Is this the final team? Orica Scott?
Final team.
The Australian World Tour team. Well, Scott make lovely environmentally friendly bicycles. Nothing more to be said. Other than the fact that Orica...
What about Orica?
Well,
what do they do?
It's the world's biggest supplier of mining explosives. They were founded under a different name of a supplier of explosive during the Victorian gold rush in the late 19th century. These days, they supply sodium cyanide for gold extraction and other chemicals. Basically, they blow things up. So not an industry that you would think sports fans would be rushing to purchase. I mean, I don't think people lining the roadside at the Tour de France will be getting on the internet to order some sodium cyanide after seeing an Orica rider win a stage. So a couple of years ago, for a Kilometre Zero on team sponsorship, I asked Shane Bannon why Orica was sponsoring a team, if not to spread the name around the world, because presumably other companies that are in the mining industry would know to buy Orica's explosives. And he said that it's more of an effort to engage the company's staff and foster team spirit and innovation and associate themselves with you know, a wholesome pursuit like bike racing. But the brutal truth is that mining is not a particularly cuddly, green or friendly business. And in recent years, there have been a lot of stories of contamination, mostly chemical leaks, chlorine, mercury, cyanide, arsenic, ammonia, sulfuric acid, all leaking into the ground or into water supplies. Something called hexavalent chromium as well, which sounds sounds pretty horrible. And the fines have really totted up. Perhaps not very much in the sort of corporate world of mining, but significant nonetheless. They were fined $432,000 in 2012 for a leak, $750,000 in 2014, and $120,000 in 2015. And it's a very dangerous...
That's like half a Yates twin, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's nothing... Well, it's certainly nothing compared to the sort of money that's in mining anyway, but... without making light of it, mining is also a very dangerous activity, and there have been fatalities associated with Orica. In 2007, there was a horrible accident in Mexico. The Washington Post reported that 28 people died when a truck carrying Orica explosives crashed into another vehicle. And in Chile in September last year, two workers died after an explosion while some maintenance was being carried out on a site. We could debate whether fatalities are a consequence of the trade. It's it is a dangerous industry, but the charge sheet doesn't really end there, because in 2015 Orica's chief executive Ian Smith left the company suddenly after allegations of bullying, and he said in the press, "I'm extremely disappointed. I was changing. Sometimes I go beyond being robust and become aggressive," which is an excuse.
We all know someone like that, don't we? I know. We all know someone like that. Well, at the end of that whistle stop tour, that's it. Who wins the yellow jersey then? I think Bora are up there. I think Dimension Data. I should mention, of course, Dimension Data's association with the Quebec charity. That's a very important part of the team, giving bikes to people throughout Africa. So I think probably Dimension Data or Bora. Any other teams, do you think, up there in terms of ethics? Cannondale, Drapac.
Yeah, and the French teams do pretty well, I think.
Really, even the baguette, even the baguettes.
AG2R's dog.
Well, yeah, and they get away lightly, the French, because Cofidis aren't in the World Tour, and Cofidis are basically sort of payday loans, making it very easy for people to borrow money at quite high interest rates. Obviously, targeting the demographic who are watching professional cycling in France, which is generally speaking a poorer section of society, isn't it? It's a bit like Wonga sponsoring a football team. There's a sort of a, you know, there's a suspicion that they're getting their talons into their core customer base, which I suppose on one hand is smart business, but you know.
Well, we're all trying to get our talons into our core customer base, aren't
we? Yeah, but you know, it's nice to wear wear a pair of gloves while doing it.
yeah. Well, listen, speaking of all that, well, we look forward to your feedback on, you know, this discussion, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Please tweet us, cycling_podcast, or email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. If you subscribe to our newsletter, which you can do at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can take part in a survey, actually, give us some feedback on last year as well, and how we did, and what you liked, what you didn't like, etc. Please do fill in that survey. Some really interesting responses so far. Thank you for all that. Before we go today, just let's hear from my visit to a little theatre in London the other night, where I saw a screening of half of the new David Miller film, which is called Time Trial. That is the name of the film. Lots of potential meaning in that as regards David Miller. There are flashbacks to earlier in his career, some footage that I hadn't seen before, which was really interesting, I thought. It's a fascinating film. I think cycling fans will love it. The some of the footage inside the race, you know, with cameras on David's bike, motorbikes that they had specially lined up, and microphones as well on the riders, and capturing, you know, bits of dialogue in the bunch. I said Mark Cavendish is very vocal. That perhaps won't surprise a lot of people, but it's really good, really interesting. As I say, I think cycling fans will really want to see it. It's going to be in American cinemas in April, and British and perhaps European as well in June, and it's hoping to get it into the Cannes Film Festival in May. So let's hear from first of all from Seb Piquet, who was there, and he's the voice of Radio Tour, of course, and tells us what he thinks of the film, then David Miller, and then the film director, Finlay Pretzel.
Okay, I've run into a friend of the podcast, Seb Piquet, in London. Seb, you're here. You've just watched 40 minutes of the David Miller film, which we now know is called Time Trial. This has been in the works for years. This is the first time you've seen any of it. What did you make of it?
Honestly, when I came here, I absolutely didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what the story was about. I didn't know what I would see on the screen. And I actually was ready to criticize everything and to point out the bad sides and what didn't work out. And at the end, after 40 minutes, I thought it was really good. And what I really liked was the fact it wasn't perfect. And the sound is absolutely outstanding. A sound like no one has ever heard on a cycling documentary or on light and live coverage. You feel you're inside the peloton.
David, is that the first time you've seen that 40-minute version of the film? What does it feel like watching it?
What does it feel like? I welled up a bit at one point with the archive footage, so I remember how young I was. But no, it was very satisfying to seeing it. It's coming together. It actually feels like a proper film now. It reminds me of bike racing, and it reminds me of everything that happened. So, yeah, pleased.
You probably need reminding now, do you?
Yeah, I do. I'm so old. I'm 40. To see pictures like footage of me when I'm 23, I'm like, oh, wow.
I used to be 23. Some great footage I haven't seen before of you in 1999 with the yellow jersey. Sorry, 2000. With the yellow jersey in your hotel room and stuff. Never seen that before. Where has that come from?
I don't know where it's France 2. I think it might have been France 2 that gave us a video camera for the room and said, can you get some footage? Or it was ITV, I can't remember. I think even from all the archive search, they can't figure out it exists, but nobody can quite remember. So I think that's what happened. Either ITV or France 2 gave us a little video camera and said, can you just get a little... some images of David in the evening and the morning just for our little thing that they do, little resume.
So what's next with the film? When is it going to be finished and when are people going to be able to see it?
Well, hopefully it's finished depending on funding in the next 6 weeks. And then in a dream scenario, we can get to see it and it gets an entry, which would be the absolute dream scenario. But otherwise, I think we're going for cinema releases in June, because it is a cinema film. And we're going to do some screening in the States in April, limited screenings. But yeah, it's going to be quite a slow release. But basically, pre-tour this year, will be finished.
Okay, I've grabbed Finlay Pretzel here. Hello, Finlay.
Hi, Richard.
The director of a film that we now know is called Time Trial. Explain the title.
Well, it's the trial of time, if you like, when David is at the end of his road, and it's his speciality. It has a plethora of meanings, really.
Deep.
Absolutely.
Where are you at with the film in terms of getting it finished, getting it funded? I gather you're still looking for money, but what are the next few months going to look like?
We're going to fine cut the film. We're going to basically work with this great editor, Dino Jonsäter, who, Swedish guy, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and Let the Right One In, great films. He's going to work on this structure, really. And we have 85 minutes on a timeline. We have a film. You could watch a film in its present state at the moment, but we just need to nip and tuck it a little bit, and it'll be done. Finally.
And you are still looking for some money.
Yes, we're almost, we have 82% funded, but we just need that little bit more to get us over the line to get to Cannes, basically. That's our plan. We're so close now. It's not like, and we have a film. It's not 2 years ago when we started to raise finance for the film before, we raised a huge chunk in such a short amount of time, and now it's just this end. We're there. We're finished, you know. As I say, we have the film.
So you're happy with it?
Yeah. It's only like in the last maybe month that I was thinking, this is the film I actually wanted to make. And it only came, it's just like, it almost knocks you for six. You're like, oh, right, yeah, this is it. this is how, what we've been looking for. It just works. It just, it's that experience. It's the emotional, exhausting story that, you know, that I think works beautifully, actually, now. It's kind of strange to be saying it in a way. It's like, but yeah, it's there. It's quite exciting. I'm also tired. It's also,
you look tired.
And it gets to this point and you're like, aye, 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 it's great. But I'm also tired of the film. You know, it's ready to go. It's ready to be released into the world. And, you know, that's...
Set it free.
Yeah, I'm desperate to do that. And just all this stuff that I've been talking about for so long will actually be out. And that's exciting now.
So that was a bit of reaction to the David Miller film, Time Trial. As I say, that'll be out soon. That's all for this week then. It's been a bumper edition. As I say, look forward to your feedback on the discussion about ethics and teams. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you very much.